every crisis is an opportunity for transformation. And that's true for the individual, that's true for the organization. So the organization must also view this not just as we are here to prevent mental health issues, but we are here also to allow each a person in our organization and therefore the organization to achieve their highest potential. And the way we achieve our highest potential is achieved through the journey in trying to take care of stress, anxiety, and depression. So the journey that begins with saying, let's just take care of stress, anxiety, and depression, ultimately is a journey towards one's highest potential. And that's the way I think we should understand it, because then it's really worth doing.
Hello and a warm welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I am your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. While they're ruthless in pursuing their ambition, they don't stray from being leaders who are not just admired for the vision and relentless pursuit, but also for how they're building an ecosystem of believers who consistently push the boundaries. In each episode, I speak to one such leader, talking to her or him or them about their businesses, lives, inspirations, interests, challenges, pivot moments and turning points, successes and failures, and of course, the little joys and agonies and ecstasies of life. It is as much about their personal life stories as about their entrepreneurial, professional and philanthropic journeys. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms. In this episode, we'll delve deep into how our workplaces, our office environment, cost our state of mind. More employees are now finding themselves caught in the tangle of stress, anxiety that comes back home with them each day. The data is telling. Data reveals that 42% of corporate employees report symptoms of anxiety or depression. That is more than 4 out of 10. The problem is so big that it costs businesses more than ₹1,10,000 crore annually, and that's an eye-popping number. Well, clearly, it is no longer a simple human resource or HR issue and deserves serious efforts in the right direction. To decode the challenges and suggest steps to better the situation, we are joined by Dr. Shyam Bhatt, the chairperson of Live, Love, Laugh Foundation. His expertise puts Dr. Shyam among less than 600 medical professionals worldwide with postgraduate training and American board certifications in psychiatry and internal medicine. He's also accredited with evidence-based psychotherapy, integral self-therapy. As we discuss mental health at workplaces, who better to talk to than Dr. Bhatt, who is regarded as a pioneer of holistic psychiatry in India. Welcome, Dr. Shyam. Delighted to have you on Unusual Suspects.
Thank you, Gaurav. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for highlighting such an important topic, and one I think that a lot of people are increasingly becoming aware of. So I'm really glad that we can have this discussion today.
Absolutely. You know, with the number of people in the workforce rising, and we have an army of people that joins the workforce or the queue of job hopefuls every year, and because we are a young population, we are a young country, our demography is structured in a manner currently that more and more people will be joining the queue of job seekers. That said, there is also a jump in the percentage of people experiencing mental health issues. A part of that also could be because there is more reporting now and people are reporting mental health issues. However, I think mental health has become far more, you know, pronounced now than, say, about 10 years ago. How worrying, in your view, is this trend according to you? And how also does a common man distinguish general work stress or a burnout from an underlying or developing mental health issue? Because there could be a tendency to conflate the two. That is, you are conflating work-related pressure with mental health. I think fundamentally these two can be very different, isn't it, Dr. Shyam?
Absolutely, Gaurav. Stress has become so commonplace that it's probably, in a way, the new normal, because everywhere you look, you see people who are stressed, who are functioning with stress and anxiety. I think the number of 42% is probably an underestimate of how many people suffer from stress. It's almost inevitable that living in today's world means that you're going to be subject to a lot of stress. And, you know, it often reminds me of Jay Krishnamurti's famous quote where he said, and, you know, I'm paraphrasing, something like, it's not a sign of health to be adjusted to a profoundly sick society. Our society has become extremely high pressure, unrelenting pressure of ambition and uncertainty. It's hyper connected. There's so much information. And obviously, this also impacts people's lifestyles, priorities, relationships. And so what we are seeing is an alarming increase in mental health issues in the workplace and around the world, everywhere in society, not just because of better awareness or better diagnosis, that's part of the story, but it's also because we are living in an extremely difficult environment, one that is calling upon organizations and people to really look at this and take this seriously. Now, the problem is because it's ubiquitous, because stress is everywhere, a person listening to this might say, listen, everybody's going through this. And maybe actually you've already heard stuff about managing stress and you've tuned it out because, you know, it's just so commonplace. But I think the first step is really to recognize, yes, it's a huge issue. And secondly, it is a concern. In fact, it's probably the biggest crisis of our lifetime, which is mental health crises, you know, the mental health challenge to our society, to our species. Already, suicide is the leading cause of death in this country for younger people. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of people who are really suffering from a lot of stress. And so the second part of your question, which was how do you distinguish between this quote unquote normal stress, which again, to emphasize, should not be accepted as something that we live with. And I'm sure we're going to talk more about how to manage that. But how to distinguish between that and mental health issues? Well, I think the important thing to realize is stress is a part of life, and that's not the issue. The issue is chronic, unrelenting stress without recovery. When a person is stressed emotionally, there's a lot of deadlines, a lot of work. They're trying to juggle between multiple roles and responsibilities. There's an increasing sense of meaninglessness, existential concerns. A person starts then experiencing chronic stress and possibly burnout. And everyone has to be aware of what are the red flags. The red flags are, it's not just usual stress that comes and goes, but number one, there's a loss of joy. You start feeling that what used to energize or inspire you is starting to feel burdensome or meaningless. Two, there are changes in sleep, appetite, or energy. And especially if they last for more than 2 weeks, we take it quite seriously. And I have to underline that people go through these problems for months, if not years, before they seek help. And our bar is much lower because we know that even if you're experiencing persistent problems with sleeping, eating, not eating much, sleeping terribly, even though you have the time to sleep, then that's an issue. Thirdly, cognitive issues, difficulty remembering, forgetfulness, attention problems, concentration problems, a constant feeling of being overwhelmed and having a sense of fogginess in the head. Emotional dysregulation is another big red flag, something that should alert a person that they need to seek help. And this can, like all these symptoms can start slow and slowly build over time. So emotional dysregulation means getting irritable more than usual, emotional outbursts, a sense of numbness or detachment, a sense of disconnection emotionally from other people. Another big constellation of symptoms, a very significant, I think, way in which people experience anxiety or stress, particularly in our country, is physical symptoms. We often think of mental health as, you know, mental, and that the physical has nothing to do with it. And, you know, the reason I trained in both internal medicine, psychiatry, and something called psychosomatic medicine is because for a long time, historically, mental health ignored the physicality of emotions. Recently, that's changing, thankfully, but that was ignored for the longest time. And our diagnostic systems reflect this this gap in awareness in our own, I think, field for the longest time, where we assume that people will have depression, anxiety, stress, and it has to show up mentally. But very, very often, people experience physical symptoms, which are unexplained headaches, digestive issues, chronic fatigue, back pain, neck pain, things like that. And if someone's experiencing chronic physical problems for which there's no specific physical cause for it and they've gone to their doctor and checked it out, then they really should be alerted to the fact that, you know, there's quite possibly some stress going on that needs to be looked into. So awareness is really important, and awareness in terms of all of these issues, awareness by the leaders and awareness, the employees and everybody involved has to be aware of their own mental health journey.
Yes, absolutely, Dr. Shyam. You know, awareness is the critical starting point. You know, just let's look at some numbers. And I'm going to quote a survey which is of not very recent. It's a very recent Vivian page, not very old, 2022. A Deloitte survey found that 80%, that is 8 out of 10, of the workforce experiences mental health issues. And nearly half of those actually consider workplace-related stress as the biggest factor affecting their mental health. The problem, as I said, is unignorable, and you know, with 1.1 lakh crore annually costing businesses probably, and that could be an underestimation. Yet, we just do not give the importance that it deserves. Where are the gaps? Awareness, of course, is one of them, but being aware and actually fixing the problem is another. Where are the gaps, do you think, Dr. Shah?
That's a great question. And clearly there are gaps because as you've, you know, you shared the statistics, we know that almost everybody in the workforce is susceptible, and 70 to 80% of people are actually experiencing mental health issues. And yet we are the situation where there are clear challenges and gaps. I think there are a few different gaps that I see when I work with organizations. Firstly, there's a gap between awareness and action clearly, because for a long time, and this is because of sort of historically, I think how mental health was viewed in society and organizations, mental health was often seen as a kind of a soft issue, which HR has to maybe look at as a reactive measure. And as long as there's no obvious issue, mental health was seen as not very important. And so what that's led to over time is systems that are not designed within organizations to translate awareness into action. And what are those? Well, firstly, we still continue to see a big gap in terms of the person experiencing problems and the ability to talk to somebody about it. And the gap is often still because of stigma, because of worries that they'll be seen as weak or less capable. You know, we know that there's confidentiality. And when I work with companies and people in the companies, leaders, employees, team members, etc., often people still don't have that confidence that they can approach mental health services, especially when there are mental health services which are located within the organization, or if they feel that HR will come to know, they're extremely resistant to seeking help. So part of that is the is that perception, and that perception needs to change within organizations. Secondly, there's individuals' own internalized shame about mental health, and that continues to be a big problem, although obviously in the last 5 years, especially perhaps among the younger generation, that's changing quite a bit, which is that people having their own sense of shame where they feel there's something wrong with them if they're going through mental health issues. And that also can be solved by increasing awareness within organizations. Finally, I think there's a big gap between the strategy and care and the structure. Now, let's say we get to a point where increasingly people are aware that we need to do something about mental health. That is probably the biggest health crisis facing our employees and our organization. We start now becoming aware that it directly impacts productivity and growth of the company and the bottom line, even if you were to just look at that. So it makes sense in every way. It's great for people. It helps them thrive. It helps them grow, and it helps the company. But why is it not happening? Well, we have to look at the granularity of it. Number one, do leaders actually model emotional intelligence? I often find that if we work with leadership and we start shifting the ways in which leadership genuinely sees and thinks of mental health, if they start understanding that it is a very critical aspect of life, including work life. And for example, I find that if a leader has been on a mental health journey themselves, they're far more likely to be emotionally intelligent in this area. So I think leadership has to model vulnerability and emotional intelligence. And of course, many of them intuitively and naturally do, which is why they're in the positions of leadership. But this is an area where obviously we are not taught about this directly in school. We all know that organizations are based on culture, and that culture is about interpersonal communication, and interpersonal communication is about emotional intelligence. And yet we all have had to learn this on our own, more or less. There's never been a course in school. And I think that's, by the way, a huge gap in our educational system, that later on in life, we learn that almost everything we do is going to be affected by one's own mental health. And yet we haven't learned specific strategies. So leadership has to see emotional intelligence as being a really important part of their leadership toolkit, and one that they have to hone and become really adept at. When they do that, that really trickles down, percolates down into teams and into the entire organization. So we also therefore want to look at managers. Are managers trained to recognize their own signs of burnout, the ways they handle their own pressures, and are they trained to be empathic with their team members and to recognize, for example, signs of burnout or ways of communication, or when to help someone with maybe have a conversation and then direct them to a resource? And you can do that if there's a culture of acceptance, vulnerability in the right way, and emotional intelligence. So psychological safety is a term that is used, which essentially means that it is safe to basically be allowed to share to some extent one's feelings, especially when it pertains to how you're feeling at work, and then get support necessary when necessary. So it's about creating conditions for flourishing of human beings in the workplace that will help both the obviously people in every way, in every aspect of their life, as well as the organization, Gaurav.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Shyam, you talked about creating a culture of acceptance and vulnerability in the positive sense, the concept of psychological safety. In that context, what role can sensitization play in this? And how you did talk about the managers, and how can leaders normalize mental health conversations at work? Because currently, it's just there's a lot of stigma associated. We continue to remain associated with mental health issues, and we just continue to ignore it. So how do we actually begin sensitizing it and also normalize these conversations? It has to start with the leaders, isn't it?
Yeah, it has to start with the leaders. Of course, workshops are important in terms of awareness workshops, etc. But in parallel, as I said, it's really important for leaders to start changing, or if they have to basically, essentially, the idea is that the leadership has to lead not just with strategy, but with humanity. To, for example, share their own experiences with stress. We're not talking about oversharing, but just some amount of sharing, some amount of vulnerability sends a very powerful signal. It says that, look, it's safe to talk about this, and that you don't have to be perfect, and that thriving in this organization or is about, you can actually share vulnerability, take care of your mental health, and that will help you be more emotionally well. And that's not a sign of weakness, but a part of resilience. So that's important. The second thing is, sometimes I feel organizations get quite reactive if there is someone who's gone through a mental health crisis in their organization, or they hear about something. Sometimes they'll react to that and maybe have a few workshops, a few campaigns, but that is not sustained, and that doesn't result in any change in culture or practice. So the second important thing is to know that you can't do one-off things. There has to be, it's not a one-off campaign or a one-off workshop. There have to be ongoing embedded practices within the organizations, which include training for managers, confidential pathways for employees to seek help, how to check in, how to know the emotional temperature of employees or the team members, not just project updates. And this actually can become easy and integrated within the fabric of organizational culture, so that it stops being reactive. It is very proactive and it's cultural. I think the third thing is to make it measurable and accountable. So we have to figure out within organizations how to have a certain surveys or data metrics that are not just HR metrics, but they must be part of the leadership dashboard. And so We're talking about evolving leadership from obviously command and control to empathic, conscious, compassionate leadership.
Absolutely.
That's the most important thing.
Yes, indeed. Continuing on the same lines, you know, the Live, Love, Love Foundation recently released its corporate mental health and well-being program. How can such research-backed initiatives help companies build mentally resilient workplaces? Because you need to have mentally resilient and mentally healthy resources to achieve. It's also a business outcome in many ways. Can you enlist a few highlights of the program?
So Gaurav, the Live, Love, Laugh Corporate Mental Health Program has a few key pillars. The first is we provide a psychometrically validated assessment. We're doing it along with the McKinsey Health Institute. And so what we do is provide a survey which gives us anonymous data-driven insights. And so organizations and leadership understand their employee mental health and well-being across key dimensions. Once they do that, then they receive a customized report from us, which is based on this assessment. And this report highlights themes such as leadership commitment, workload sustainability, stigma, and signs of burnout, anxiety, depression, and stress. So we discuss these reports with the leadership team, and that helps them translate this data into clear steps. We then provide the companies with a tailored roadmap so that they can actually make organization-specific changes and take targeted interventions. A lot of companies do allocate now increasingly resources on mental health, but are not clear about where they should be spending this money or these resources. You know, for example, what is the combination of therapy or preventive strategies that they might have to consider? So there are a lot of pieces to mental health, both in terms of prevention and treatment. And companies, although there are certain universal themes like we've talked about today, each company is slightly different in terms of exactly where the hotspots might be, which areas we might want to start working on first, and so on and so forth. And so it's important for companies to have a very strategic, efficient use of their mental health resources. So those are the key highlights of the Live, Love, Laugh corporate program, Gaurav. And the reason we're doing this initiative is because we know that people spend most of their day, most of their life in that sense, in organizations. We know that therefore organizations are very powerful in the ways that they can shape their employees' mental health. And because we are facing a national crisis of mental health, and because it is both a healthcare challenge as well, and I must emphasize, it's not just a challenge, and we've been talking about that, it is also an opportunity for transformation. Yes. You know, if you think about mental health as merely we are here to look at, you know, prevention of stress, anxiety, burnout, that's all very well, very well. But I think we zoom out and see that existentially, this is what the human being has had to contend with in one form or the other. It's more amplified in today's world, which is really, how do you have a balanced, happy life? It's a very deep question, and one that you can postpone, but which will come up in various ways across, you know, through one's journey. Now, as a practitioner, when I work with individuals, you know, we always see that while they may have come into seeing a therapist or psychiatrist because of certain concerns, in taking care of those concerns, they actually find and transform into their most authentic, highest self, if you like, in the sense that every crisis is an opportunity for transformation. And that's true for the individual, that's true for the organization. So the organization must also view this not just as we are here to prevent mental health issues, but we are here also to allow each a person in our organization, and therefore the organization, to achieve their highest potential. And the way we achieve our highest potential is achieved through the journey in trying to take care of stress, anxiety, and depression. So the journey that begins with saying, let's just take care of stress, anxiety, and depression, ultimately is a journey towards one's highest potential. And that's the way I think we should understand it, because then it's really worth doing.
Absolutely, indeed. You know, Dr. Shyam, you have also developed the integral self-therapy, which kind of integrates insights from Eastern meditative practices with contemporary therapeutic techniques to facilitate self-realization. Can this be something that organizations can adopt at a bigger level and also scale to smoothen the friction around mental health?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. It's something that's very close to my work, which is integral self-therapy is a form of therapy I developed about 15 years ago while I was still in the US at that time. And the reason I developed is that this therapy is because I started to see some of the strengths, of course, of Western-based therapeutic models, but also some of the real limitations. And I saw that if those that form of therapy, the forms, and I by this I mean all the forms of therapy purely from the West, I saw that those forms of therapy, while they can be empowering in the short term and helpful, in the longer term, they do not help the individual, they do not help communities, and they do not help society. And the data, of course, is self-evident. I mean, the West, the United States in particular, has plenty of therapists and psychiatrists, and many more people see therapists and take treatment, and yet look at outcome measures in terms of homicide, suicide, depression, anxiety, relational problems, isolation. It's terrible. So it's clear that there's an interplay between culture, identity, and psychotherapy. And so that's one of the big reasons I actually was really motivated also to coming back to India at that time, which was the vision, the idea that our therapists in India cannot and should not learn purely from Western theoretical models and Western theorists. And what do we need? Well, what we need is an integration of perennial insights about anxiety, stress, depression, and existential concerns that a rich culture like ours has had for thousands of years. And it's ironic that thousands of years ago, we developed practices like meditation and yoga, and the philosophy and practice of clarifying the real nature of the self, which was that the real self is not any construct, but rather something transcendent, best encapsulated in the Advaita school or non-duality. And what the Western theorists and Western psychotherapy and Western culture, in fact, does is emphasize hyper-individualism. Hyper-individualism is a more and more clear delineation of the individual with strict boundaries and further definitions and categorizations of the individual. It sounds empowering to people from collectivist societies like India because, in a way, that it is a counterbalance to feeling that you as an individual didn't have place in a collectivist society. But as an enduring philosophy of life and psychotherapy, it ultimately results in fragility, disconnection, and all the problems we're seeing in the West. So it was clear to me that what we needed, there were advantages to both schools, to both forms of seeing the self. And integral self-therapy is an integration of the profound ideas, philosophies, and practices from the East, including the clarification of the real nature of the self, which is non-dual or transcendent, along with the idea that yes, there is the individual nature of the self quite clearly, especially in today's world where we all live in individualized worlds, whether it is in the West or the East. So integral self-therapy says, how can you harness the power of transcendence to actually become even better at everything you do, which is including work and success and things that might seem materialistic, but engaging with it with the right sense of play, joy, liberation that can only come when we detach from the constructs of the individual self while still, in a way, connecting with it, if that makes sense. So it's a balance between the transcendent and the individual, the East and the West. It's called integral self-therapy. It includes mind-body practices and various meditative practices. And the reason that I think it's important to bring about cultural elements as well as practices from yoga, meditation, somatic therapy from the East is we get better outcomes. There's increasing data about that. In fact, I'm also looking at we are conducting certain research trials. We published two papers in the past, but we are publishing more papers about this. And therefore, for companies, it's important to integrate, have this right therapeutic approach, because especially obviously for our country, because we cannot simply apply Western concepts of happiness, health, or healing to our country.
Absolutely, indeed, we cannot supplant a Western model into an Indian culture. This reminds me of a book by S. Radhakrishnan by the name Eastern Mysticism and Western Thought. Your response kind of resonated deeply with that. Finally, Dr. Shyam, of late, it's a cross-cultural question. Of late, offices in Japan have started incorporating sleeping pods to improve employee well-being and productivity. And we also have seen in Australia last year implementing the right to disconnect, giving employees the right to ignore work-related emails, messages, and calls, etc. My question is more about India. Can we import this kind of a model and, you know, start executing here on at scale? Because as you'd believe and you'd agree that India currently runs on WhatsApp and it just doesn't stop beeping for employees. So how can it go about actually creating something similar to what Japan and Australia is doing, but in a culture that fits into India's way of life? Dr. Shyam?
Well, one of the things about, I think, India is that we are more nuanced in many ways, and quite it's hard to categorize India and the dynamic nature of our quite diverse society. And I think a good sort of organizational culture will have a little bit of nuance and flexibility. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. I think we do recognize that we are connected and we have to be. But the leadership first has to examine that and ask themselves two questions, right? Which is, what is the best way to enhance employee health? What's the best way to enhance employee productivity? Both are reasonable questions. And both are actually interdependent questions that are synergistic. And in the sense that when you help health, you help productivity. I think the leadership should start becoming aware of some of the things that are done out of anxiety and stress and not out of efficiency and productivity, and to know which is which. Just simply to respond to messages or to be quick in terms of electronic communication to show that one is alert may actually be addressing some other issues rather than productivity. So I think we have to ask the question, you know, we're asking the question to the employee, we're asking, what is the most sustainable way in which you can work well in this organization? And so that might include sleep pods. I think that's a good idea. A few naps, a short siesta in the afternoon is useful. The other thing about more rigid boundaries between work and life would definitely in many, I think, be an ideal. It cannot be easily enforced. I think it's hard to make real. And I think it's important that the organization says what it's going to do. I think that there has to be an alignment between what the organizations and leaders say they believe in, what they say that they're interested in, and then in the culture and expectations within the organization. Authenticity and alignment, walking the talk, is one of the most important things right now for mental health and organizations. I'm saying this and underlining this because, you know, what's happening in a way, Gaurav, is that many companies are recognizing. But I think when we start talking about it and then nothing changes within the organization, then that breeds a lot of cynicism amongst people, employees, and so on. It would a person would rather be told that, look, this is the way work is, and this is the way we have to show up. And then the organization can ask the question, is this sustainable for the organization? Does this meet long-term goals for this organization? And they have to be they need to take time to reflect. And that's why any change needs a little bit of stepping away from the inertia of doing what we always do. And I want to make that very clear. This is a podcast in many ways. You know, when we talk also, it can be something just good to hear and good to say. But for me, I'm working in the real world. I see real people who are suffering real problems. And I see, you know, people also who are dying from this, literally. To me, it's an urgent, serious problem. And it means that everyone listening, every leader can ask themselves a question. I don't have to say it to them. Everybody is very, very informed, smart, and reflective enough to just answer this question. Is it a big thing in my life, this quest for balance between all the things that I desire and maintaining my mental health? Is it difficult? What are the ways in which I'm sustaining my mental health and nurturing that? And then in what way can I help this organization be that place which can help so many people? Our country it's really important for our country that, especially the youngest people, that we create organizations where they can thrive, you know, where their mental health thrives and their productivity thrives. And it's so essential, it's obvious, we need that for our country. And the world of commerce and the world of mental health rarely meet in that sense. But really, they're inextricably linked. We cannot do good commerce, do good leadership, good productivity without good mental health. So that's a really important message I want to underline, that this is real. You can do something about it. Change starts with each individual for themselves, and then making changes within our immediate environment, and that will trickle and percolate and spread all through the organization.
Absolutely. Very well said. Thank you so much, Dr. Shyambhat, for sharing your deep insights and perspectives and taking the time out to drop by and have this conversation with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gaurav, and truly a pleasure talking with you today on such an important topic. Thank you.